Have you noticed that politicians struggle to enact the things they run on? That regardless of Putin's elections, lawmakers cannot pass whatever legislation they like. They find themselves bound by what is popular, or at least their sense of it. They can only act within a narrow set of ideas, and that range is called the Overton Window. And on the Overton Window podcast, we look at issues around the country and talk to the people who change what is politically possible. Now, since popularity drives policy, today we're talking with someone who explicitly wants to persuade. Josh Bandock is the head of policy at the Illinois Policy Institute, where he tries to convince people that solving poverty is more about removing barriers to work than it is about transferring more money. And you'll have to wait to check out his upcoming book on persuasion. Josh, welcome.
James, it's a real pleasure to be here. Thank you.
What do you want out of poverty policy?
What I want out of poverty policy is to empower people to rise and unleash their potential. That's my North Star. So I want policies that both make that more likely and also to remove bad policies that create barriers to people doing great things, creating value for themselves and others.
So what actually do you want then?
Yeah, so specifically, we have here a Center for Poverty Solutions. And what we're doing is working at the nexus of research and then just on the ground direct service providers, like working with individuals in poverty. So in line with that center, I started last fall to dive into poverty research and just sort of looked around at lots of top think tanks and found surprising consensus across seven issues. So what I want is progress on these seven issues, because there is consensus that these are things we need to do to actually empower people to rise out of poverty. So what are those things? The first is to empower people through the dignity of work. Let me toss out some stats. The poverty rate in Chicago is 17.2%. For folks who were unemployed last year, it was 39.7%. For folks who worked full-time, 2.3%. Simple data. We know that work empowers people. And it's really important to have that narrative, because it is also just important to us as humans to work. The second thing is to prepare for the future of work, because we could solve poverty today only to see people fall back into poverty tomorrow because of the way the economy is evolving, technology, AI, all sorts of things like that. And if you're not sure about that, look at the Rust Belt. Look at those towns where the factory left. What do they do? We need an answer to that. The third thing is to remove barriers to work, things that make it harder for people to enter the workforce and to unleash their potential. The biggest one we're focusing on is occupational licensing, which is a government permission slip to make an honest living. The fourth thing we're looking at is to reform safety net programs to make sure that they don't provide disincentives to work. Things like benefit cliffs. A benefit cliff is basically when someone increase their income by a certain amount, they lose all typically of the benefits, which can sometimes total up to $15,000. That provides a steep cliff and a disincentive for people to work. The fifth thing to be looking at is...
I want to stop. I'm at
point. For please.
Because some of the highest taxes that people pay wind up being on poor people through these eligibility rules.
Yeah, that's right.
Where you earn a little bit more, you lose a lot more.
That's right. Last week, one thing that we're doing here at IPI is we are meeting with direct service providers. So last week we had a meeting with the folks who are doing this on the ground. Met this guy for the first time. Literally the first thing out of his mouth, he said, are you guys doing anything with benefit cliffs? And I was like, funny you should say that. He said, because all the time we hear people, he works in workforce development, all the time people come to us and they say, I can't take this raise. I can't take this promotion because it's going to essentially send me over the benefit cliff because I'm going to lose all these benefits. That's a terrible perverse incentive. So what we're looking at is to, this is a federal thing, and we think that states can do more to smooth out these cliffs and to provide people a fair off-ramp so that they aren't disincentivized to get a promotion, to get a raise, things like that. Just to kind of go quickly through the last couple, and then please fire away. Whilst looking at the education system, it has to be high quality, and we think that we need to reorient it from what I think is a mistaken approach and focus on degrees to a focus on careers, which means that, sure, college is great for some people, and for other folks, an apprenticeship, vocational training, things like that is a great way to earn a living. People who complete apprenticeships make $22,000 more per year than the average American worker. That's pretty good. We're also looking at housing affordability because the first of every month, everyone's reminded housing is an issue. And in Illinois in particular, we have the highest percentage of households that are burdened by housing cost of any Midwestern state. And the last thing we look at is family structure, because we know it matters that nationally the poverty rate is 11.5%. Folks that follow what's called the success sequence, finish high school, get a full-time job, get married, then have kids, their poverty rate is about 2%. And we know that that's really important.
So that's a really ambitious agenda. How are you trying to get it accomplished?
Can't eat an elephant in one sitting. So we're focused on a couple of discrete things. And part of what we're trying to do with the Poverty Center is work at the nexus. So we're listening to our direct service providers and trying to look for opportunities. And then what I'm also doing is, when I step back a second, wrote this report, I thought, well, I operate in Illinois. So what does it look like to pursue persuasive poverty advocacy in Illinois? And part of that is understanding that you're operating in a blue state. So we're looking for opportunities that might look a little bit different than if you work, say, in Florida or Texas, that might be a little more amenable to free market ideas. So the three areas that we're focusing on, broad speaking policy-wise, one is housing affordability. Mayor Brandon Johnson released a report back in April called Cut the Tape. Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson released a report back in April called Cut the Tape, which is a pretty solid report that has a lot of recommendations to at least reduce the insane amount of red tape that anybody who wants to build anything in Chicago faces. So we see that as a real opportunity. So we're doing a lot of research there. We're looking at occupational licensing because Governor Pritzker of Illinois has shown some real appetite to at least reduce some of these burdens. And we expect that to, he just signed a couple of bills a couple of weeks ago, and we expect that to continue next year. So that's an opportunity. And then we're also looking at apprenticeship as a way to empower people, because again, we've seen at least at the state level appetite for more apprenticeships. So we're focusing on those areas.
So that's an interesting start, part of the strategy, because you've said that some of our agenda is going to just simply not appeal to policymakers. They're not going to take a stand. They're not going to, or at least if you are able to persuade them, it's going to take a lot of work. Yeah. So your first thing is say, okay, but where might there be agreement? Where are some opportunities? What do they want from you?
Well, so I think one thing that they do want from us, and you mentioned persuasion, is how we talk about these things is really important, because we could agree on something and alienate somebody who doesn't agree with us if we don't talk about it in a way that's effective. So what does that look like? When I talked about operating the blue state, part of that is to focus on issues that there is an intersection. And then once you engage somebody, you have to talk to them in a manner that's appealing to them. So one thing I've learned through my persuasion research is that the moral mind of folks on the left and the right, and even on the right, libertarians and conservatives, they all have somewhat different moral minds. So the leftist moral mind is really concerned, and this draws on work from people like Jonathan Haidt, is really concerned with care and equity. And equity looks at equal outcomes, and it looks at how groups are harmed by things. Folks on the right, they aren't really concerned with, and their moral mind doesn't light up. In fact, it's quite the opposite. It gets frustrated when people make claims of equity. So we could do one of two things. Let's take housing policy as an example. There is wide consensus on the left and the right that housing affordability is an issue, and that restrictive zoning policies are one big cause of that. Not the only, but one big cause of that. So what's the solution? To reduce zoning restrictions. That's a kind of simple sequence, but how we talk about those things matters. So folks on the right don't like zoning restrictions because they see it as an affront to property rights. It's my property, and I ought to be able to do with it what I want. Fair enough, and they would look at the market as a better mechanism for achieving more affordable housing. Folks on the left, they look at these policies and they see that they have racist origins, and they do. The first zoning law was passed in Baltimore, I think it was in 1910, to keep out certain folks from certain communities, really unsavory origins. So if I come in and I try to advocate with somebody on the left, property rights, property rights, property rights, I'm not going to get anywhere. If I acknowledge their concern and maybe say that, yeah, you know, some of these policies, they do have unsavory origins, that's going to resonate. And we have that shared language, which makes it much easier to work with them, to persuade them, not just to talk to me, but to actually work with me towards some policy change.
So what are some other arguments that you think are going to appeal to your friends on the left?
Well, so broadly speaking, we have to cast things in terms of care and equity because those are the concerns that really resonate with them. And we have to do though, especially through stories. So say, take the poverty stuff, right? It turns out that the seven solutions that I look at, those are market-oriented solutions. And I think that history shows us that markets are the best way to empower people to rise, that they've pulled billions of people out of poverty. And how would I talk about those solutions to people on the left? I would talk about care and how they help the people who most need help and how bad policies like occupational licensing, how they empower these people. You might even talk in terms of equity. You would say, well, occupational licensing, some of these laws also have unsavory origins, and that's unfair. So if you can just kind of put that lens on a little bit and think like someone on the left and use language that is not inauthentic to yourself, you don't want to lie or say things you don't believe, their minds really are just wired differently. And I use the wiring intentionally in the sense that like psychologists have shown that this is just part of our genetics. Up to 50% of our morality is just wired into us. So in the same way that it's not wrong that you don't have red hair or that I don't have red hair, this is at least partially an issue of wiring. If we can acknowledge that and operate within their moral universe, we're going to be a lot more effective.
When you say that you have to be worried about being inauthentic, what exactly do you mean?
So you don't want to have anybody feel like or actually attempt to manipulate anybody, because when someone feels like you might be trying to manipulate them, that's bad news. I'm not going to trust you. Destroys any chance of working together. So if I talk to somebody about housing policy and I say, you know, some of these policies do have unsavory origins, it's because there actually is a lot of data to support that. I'm not going to say something that I don't believe is true. When I talk about occupational licensing, it is true that these policies hurt the poor the most, and that makes them inequitable. It actually makes poor people, it's a huge barrier for them to enter all these industries. That does hurt them the most. That's just true. I'm not going to go and make claims, however, that are inauthentic, because I don't believe those things. And if they sense I don't believe those things, they will not trust me.
Something that's really persuasive to me is establishing that policy is effective or our current policies are ineffective. But I don't feel like I am the majority in that. Why is it that we can't just demonstrate effectiveness to be persuasive?
So that is necessary, and unfortunately, it's not sufficient. I think the most frustrating thing, uncomfortable thing that I've learned in all of my persuasion research and just actually being a persuader is that, and this is neuroscientists and psychologists, not me talking, this is how our minds work. We feel first, then reason. So it's feel, intuit, remote, and then reason. And sometimes it's feel, boom, reason. Sometimes it takes a long time, but sometimes it never happens. So this is really challenging for those of us who work at think tanks and like research, because we say, look, we did our research, here are the data, checked it, verified, like this is the problem, and we know that elsewhere this has worked. Let's do it in Michigan. Let's do it in Illinois. And that's like a sort of simple logical mathematical process, and unfortunately for the most part our brains aren't wired that way. So what does that mean? It means that we need that research as a necessary foundation. Then we need to think about how we present that information in a way that's going to persuade people. So you have to ask questions like what do you want people to feel, and like how do you generate those emotions? That's one reason why I talked about the care and equity stuff, is that one thing that makes us feel is moral claims. Either something is good or something's bad. It's right or it's wrong. So if you can make the right kinds of appeals, you can say, housing is unaffordable in Illinois. We have more households that are burning housing than any other state in the Midwest. And that hits the poor the hardest. And that's unfair. You've just tapped into some of those moral taste buds. They're like, oh, that is unfair. It hurts the poor the hardest. So how do you present that stuff? And then the next step is to tell stories. So I could say, well, benefit cliffs are a problem. Well, today I'm actually going to meet with a direct source provider, the guy I mentioned earlier, who said, are you guys working on benefit cliffs? And one thing we need are stories. So it's one thing for me to say, well, the research shows that, you know, like these cliffs are actually really steep and people don't want to fall off them. When we have stories and we say, well, actually, you know, we talked to folks in Chicago and, you know, we talked to Bersuzzi or whoever, and they actually faced this benefits cliff and they rejected a promotion that would have been really great for them. So those sorts of things are what you need to layer on top of the excellent research.
How do you know whether you're persuading people about poverty policies?
For me, persuasion is shared action. So it's shared because it's voluntary, right? There's no force involved, and it's connection that people are willing to act with you. So I think you know what's happening if people are taking steps down that road. So as we build a coalition, say, for housing, if folks are willing to engage with us, if we can say, for example, like focus on different issues, that's going to help move the ball down the field. We can go advocate together. We can meet. We can strategize. And then ultimately, is policy changed? Whether we're at the forefront or we're a little bit in the back, are we a part of a coalition where we see positive changes? In the case of housing, regulations are reduced. It's easier for people to build. And then eventually, once those regulations are reduced, we see higher permitting. We see more housing constructed, things like that. And housing affordability becomes better in Chicago. I think that's kind of the ideal for us.
So just thinking about who you are and the issues that you're engaging on, it seems like one of the biggest barriers that you might face is people simply writing you off before you even start. Like, is that true? And how do you deal with it?
100%. Funny, I'll stay in the housing thread because I had this meeting a couple weeks ago with a guy. I met him in a happy hour, and he works at a research organization, definitely leans left, but nonpartisan organization. And we're talking about maybe 15 minutes, really good conversation. I says, hey, we should meet. He was like, well, okay, maybe. And I said, okay, I'll send you some reports, I wrote poverty report and a housing report. And he was like, okay. And then sent them to him. And then we met. And basically, he said that with me. And he said, I had some priors coming into this conversation that folks like you, you know, on the right, you sort of crazy conservative or libertarian, you maniacs, that among other things, all you want to do is completely eradicate the welfare state. But like, you don't care about the people and things that I care about. And when I wrote this poverty solutions report earlier this year, I really framed it so that any reasonable person on the left could sit down with me and have a conversation. So what did he say? He said, basically, my report disarmed him, that it was written in a way that he would have conversation with me. And we met for an hour and a half, and we talked about housing policy. He's like, oh, I really like some of the things that you're doing. I hadn't thought about that. Okay, well, I'm going to send this to people on my team. And okay, let's talk again in a couple of weeks. Because I wrote that report essentially for people just like him, he engaged me in conversation. I framed it in a way that spoke to his moral mind. So I made a lot of claims about care, about how it hurts the poor, all these bad policies. In some cases, like we've discussed, some of these things are inequitable. Leaning into that language while still staying true to my principles, where I believe that markets are the best way to empower people, and just framing that in a way that resonates with people on the left as well, was really effective in this case. So I think you have to talk their moral language, and then you have to engage them in conversation and also let them know that you're not this, like, you know, sort of crazy seven-headed beast who wants to do really bad things.
When you say that markets are the best way to empower people, isn't that like one of those messages that someone who you're trying to persuade would simply turn off, as in that wouldn't appeal to them?
It might. And so I would say things like, look, I care about the poor. I would even tell part of my personal story. I've done that before, and get them to essentially understand that I care about this. And I would say, look, if we care about the poor, I want an economic system that pulls not thousands or millions, but literally billions of people out of poverty. And we have a system that has done that for centuries, and that's capitalism, right? That's the really snippet version. If I frame capitalism not in terms of freedom and markets and rights, and I love all those things, if I frame it in terms of care for the poor, and you can show it them, right, the hockey stick of history, it's an amazing thing. And the people that have benefited the most from that are the poor, because the rich, they're going to be fine no matter where they are. It's the folks that aren't in that bottom rung of the ladder that most need good policies and practices to empower them to unleash their potential, because we're all bundles of potential. So if I frame it in those terms, instead of just saying rights, freedom, markets, which if I was talking to some of our friends on the right, that would be a great way to frame it because it resonates with them. So that's how it would vary the messaging based on the audience. Same policy, different framing on it.
So I'm just trying to think about how to apply your ideas. Can you make a care, harm, or equity case for all of your policies?
I think a harm case, yes. So if we go through any of those solutions and talk about why either acting or not acting would hurt people, particularly the poor, because it's research on poverty and social mobility, yes. The equity claims, maybe not across the board, but I think there are at least enough cases where we can show that bad policies hurt the poor. So that's an equity claim because, right, they're essentially pushing poor people down or at least keeping them down because they're creating barriers. So yes, that is inequitable. And we can say that and I think still be true to free market principles because, like, when you remove that barrier, then you give opportunity to people who need it the most.
When you're crafting your paper or your arguments or your messages or however you're trying to engage your audience, how much of your time is spent trying to figure out the best appeals that are going to put you in the best position? Do you have like an editor to check for this kind of thing?
A couple of ways. And how does that look? So I do the research first, and I didn't go into my research on poverty and social mobility as I started it, knowing that these were seven areas of consensus. I just looked across from Urban Institute, even Center for American Progress, all the way over to our friends at Cato and AEI and places like that. And I just saw this consensus emerging. I'm like, yeah, it's there. So, okay, do the research first, right? And it has to be rock solid. So the data, the logic, all that stuff has to be there. And then you have the core of the report, the paper, the op-ed, whatever it is. And then once you have that set, then I think about how am I going to frame this? Introduction, conclusion, even just how I frame some of the sections and some of the claims in those sections. It's kind of like putting the ornaments on the tree, but those ornaments are really important. So then how do I know it's working when I have some folks who work here look at it and say, I don't know about that. That's kind of a funny claim. Then I know that, right, it's not exactly written for them, but this is something that is going to sort of be uncomfortable for them, but be comfortable with somebody on the left. And the goal here is to make a difference. So if I wanted to be right, that'd be easy, right? I just write things that resonate with folks who care about things like freedom and prosperity, for whom that is primary. Working in Illinois, that's not enough to make a difference. So we have to think a little bit differently and a little more strategically. And this is at least part of the strategy.
I'm struggling with how to put this one, which is the strategy that you're using. You've got your strategy, you've got your idea. How do you actually get in front of people in a way that's going to affect public policy?
Great question, right? So I had this nice theory, we write some things. What does that look like? So part of it is writing things to get that first conversation. You sit down with people and understand that you're not a seven-headed monster, but rather someone who shares a lot of concerns. And that goes a really long way. So more work that we're doing is on social mobility. I'm doing some work with the Archers Institute. They have a great report on social mobility in the 50 states. And we know that that resonated with some folks down in Springfield, the capital, where our legislature is, because they were talking about it publicly. So we made the decision to do a deep dive into social mobility in Illinois, and why is it so low? So we look for that. We know that that resonated. We can then send them this and say, Senator, we know that you care about social mobility. We did a deep dive into it. Here you go. Start a conversation with him or her and their staff, and then have that conversation, understand what their pain points are, because they might look at all these different areas of social mobility, and they may only care about one of them. That's okay. I bet we can find some areas of consensus around that. And then once you find the consensus, you can do some good things. That greases the wheels of cooperation on down the road.
Mm-hmm. So building coalitions, getting your argument out there, having meeting with people who are also engaged on this issue, and then finally meeting with policymakers to try and find out exactly what they might be interested in.
Yeah.
Has this been successful for you?
We are at the start of the process. So we started this poverty center, which is a big focus for us now, last fall. So I would say we're getting to the point now where we can activate it, where we have these stories, where we are understanding what's working on the ground with our direct source providers, building out the research. Those seven areas that I talked about, they could all be separate books and, 10 papers and things like that. So We are now in the process of starting to put this into practice. So if you have me back in a year or two, then I can say, well, these are some of the successes that we've had.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's interesting to see. What do you expect from out of the coming year?
I expect a lot of opportunity on housing. I think that, you know, to draw on the namesake of this podcast, that the Overton window is shifting on housing in a way that is towards reducing regulations and is more market oriented. And that's really exciting for us. So that's one reason why we're focusing on that, because we see it as an opportunity to pursue some really good policies, both inside this window that are also aligned with other values, and we think are just tons of research on this subject. So we're focusing on that. Same thing about occupational licensing. We see that window shifting towards Illinois is not bad relative to other states. It's like top 10, top 15 in most metrics in terms of better. So we see that as sort of shifting a little bit towards the integration to at least reduce some of the burdens.
What are you doing on those other areas that policymakers aren't interested in?
I think we're going to keep looking for opportunities. And part of it is trying to figure out where things are ripe, like doing research where, let's take housing as an issue. Taxes, that is a big component of housing policy. Taxes here are sky high. We have to be mindful of that and have good research on that. If that comes up in conversations, they say, well, what about taxes? Then we need to be prepared to have that conversation. And Illinois has the second highest effective property tax rate in the nation, behind only New Jersey. So we have to be prepared to talk about those things if they come up. And I think focusing on the issue where there's an opportunity is probably the best use of resources for now. And then doing research and looking so that when opportunity presents itself in those other areas, we're ready to act on.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you're still going to conduct research and make arguments on these policies that are outside of the Overton window, I assume, even if it's not going to be meeting with legislators who are just not going to be interested in the subject at all.
Well, and I do think that is one way that if we do it right, that we can shift that window a little bit. So, well, we've done this research. We found these things. We want you to know about it. And again, how we frame that is important. So will be a good example of that. A director of the Poverty Center, Dr. Eddie Cornegay, he likes to talk about the success sequence. And that's something that he's gotten some traction on. So if we find that, not just in the community where he's operating, but that maybe with legislators too, that's something that they start to be a little more interested in, then we can press on that a little bit more. And we'll have done the background research to say, well, we've done this. We've talked to folks in the community. It's resonating, and then kind of take it from there. So to be ready when we see opportunities or when we see some shift in that window to be able to step in with our work.
How optimistic are you about accomplishing your agenda?
I'm actually pretty optimistic. I don't think it's naivete either. I think that there is real opportunity in these areas because we focus on areas where there are consensus, and the war on poverty, that's failed. 6 years later, at least the official poverty rate has stayed in a pretty consistent window of like 11 to 15% of the population. That's tens of millions of people. So we know what we're doing isn't working. And I think that among a lot of organizations, there is at least like starting to see that, yes, this isn't working and these are some things that would be better. I'm actually pretty optimistic in this space.
Josh, good luck in your attempts to shift the Overton window.
Thank you, James.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Overton Window, a podcast from the Mackinac Center. Please subscribe and rate. For more, check us out at www.mackinac.org. That's Mackinac with a C, like the island.